The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
This morning, David Roshi and I are going to share offering this Dharma talk, this Tay Show. And I want to begin by reading a different version of the koan that we're looking into for this sesshin. The version that Alan read and explicated so beautifully yesterday is our version in Boundless Way that we inherited from our teacher's teacher, our ancestor, John Tarrant. And he went through and translated many of the koans in our so-called koan curriculum or koan collection. And we were talking about in a teacher's meeting earlier today, how all of these koans come to us from medieval China, early medieval China, the 600s to the 900s, and then they were collected a couple of centuries later. And they were translated from a language that no one speaks or reads any longer. Just like English in the time of Chaucer, if we were to look at English from that time or earlier, it would be very difficult. It is very difficult to understand things like Beowulf and the works of Chaucer. So it's multiple translations. It's like a game of telephone or whisper down the wind, where one person says something and then repeats it to another person who repeats what they heard, which isn't necessarily what was said. And then it's repeated and repeated and repeated through the centuries in different languages, from Chinese, from that ancient Chinese to Japanese of the 13th century and beyond, and then to English here in the 21st century. So every teacher who comes across these translations, every translator emphasizes something else. Sometimes a line in Chinese is just two words, two ideograms, with no other pieces, no articles, no emphases. And so the translator into English, because we have those things, adds these. And so to look at koans from this point of view, our transmission depends on understanding the meaning of a teacher's words to you directly. And then being able to, at some point, perhaps in the future, repeat those words to someone else. It's complicated. It's bound to be misunderstood. And we were very interested, Alan and David and I, in the variations of the English translations of this particular case, case 32, from the Book of Serenity or the Book of Equanimity. Even there, two different titles for the collection. This collection came from a Chinese teacher. I think he lived somewhere around 11th, 12th, 13th century, Wan Song. And he was basing the collection on an earlier collection that had been put together by one of our favorite Zen masters of the past, Hongzhi, who we read from periodically because we have a few pieces by him in our sutra book. And also he's a wonderful, or at least the way he's been translated into modern English, wonderfully reiterates the teaching that stays in our hearts that we feel we have received over the centuries. So Wan Song put this together based on the collection of Hongzhi. Wan Song often has an introduction, a commentary. Hongzhi has a poem, and then Wan Song comments on the poem if we were to really dive even more deeply into this koan, it would take weeks, months, years, maybe our entire lives. But we only have these 2 days. So we're going to look, or I want to look at one piece of this very different translation. So when you hear it, having heard it yesterday, or maybe having worked on it, if you've done koan practice in the Book of Serenity, noticing what arises for you freshly. And that includes confusion or not understanding, as well as maybe something that touches you, like so many people talked about yesterday. Something touches us when we hear the words of the Dharma. It's not exactly intellectual or emotional or physical or spiritual. I'm making up these four categories. It's some mixture of all of them, and it's not explicable. You can't really put words on it, but you know it when you taste it. So here's a translation by, I believe it's Thomas Cleary. Yes. He and his brother translated the Blue Cliff Record, which is also a wonderful standard translation that our koan translations differ from slightly. Yangshan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Yu province." Yangshan said, "Do you think of that place?" The monk said, "I always think of it." Yangshan said, "The thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thought to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there?" The monk said, "When I get here, I don't see any existence at all." Yangshan said, "This is right for the stage of faith, but not yet for the stage of person." The monk said, "Don't you have any other particular way of guidance?" Yangshan said, "To say that I have anything particular or not would not be accurate. Based on your insight, you only get one mystery. You can take the seat and wear the robe after this. See on your own." So a couple of important differences between this version and the other version, and we can't know where they come from, but we can let ourselves be inspired by the variation. I was saying to the teachers earlier that it's a little bit like a GPS system. You can find your way without necessarily being guided by one satellite in the sky. You need other satellites. You need really your own experience more than anything else, and the capacity to meet these koans, these stories, these teachings through that experience, your life, how things are for you. As Alan mentioned yesterday, the first question is quite different. We say, "Where were you born?" And Yangshan in this version says, "Where are you from?" Where are you from? Where were you born? And then the follow-up question to, "From Yu province," or I could say Boston or wherever, Seattle, where Alan was born. Yangshan says, "Do you think of that place?" In our translation, we say, "Do you consider the inside of it?" Which is really interesting and quite different. Do you think of that place? Well, of course I do. And sometimes I think of it with great longing. I spent 17 years of my life, 18 years of my life in Boston and near Boston. And that was my home for all those years. And then I had to leave home. And sometimes there's a wistfulness that arises. You could say that it's just a series of created narratives. And yet it has some kind of a punch to it. It's quite poignant for me to think of Boston. So when the monk says, I always think of it, whether he's responding to the question, do you get to the inside of it or do you always think of it? We don't really know what his experience is. But based on some of the commentaries, he's not as much of a fool as he sometimes can appear. He actually is being very honest. He's saying, I always think of it. Well, of course, I was taught when I studied psychology that whenever the word always comes into play, you know it's a lie, because nobody can do anything always. And that's been a real lovely guidepost for me in my own conversations with myself. If I say, I always do this, or I always think that, then maybe I can wake up out of the fog of that particular thing and realize that's not true. Many things are constantly going on in the inside of it, what John Tarrant points to in his translation of this line, do you always think of it? Are you inside of it? Can you go inside of it? Can you see the masses of thoughts arising and falling away? Arising and falling away. And then can you let yourself, as we talked about yesterday, be interrupted? Can you let yourself be interrupted by something that isn't the crawl screen of your mind, the endless narratives that we rehearse, the same old songs? Can you be surprised, as we say? Can the sound of the bird outside the window suddenly interrupt the crawl screen? Can a feeling in your body or a sense perception suddenly interrupt that flow, and then you see how it's all pieced together, these mind moments that we string together as if there was no space in between them. But of course there's space in between them. And when we let ourselves get interrupted, then we perceive that very thing. Yangshan says, the thinker is the mind, okay, and the thought of is the environment. We can go with that. The things that are outside of us, the environment, are what we think about. And the inner experience, which is probably why John Tarrant translated that line as, do you consider the inside of it? The inner experience is commentary, reflection, mirroring, narrative construction, many, many things. And then he says, Yangshan says, inside the environment, inside the thought of, inside therein are all those things, mountains, rivers, buildings, towers, people, animals. And then he gives this interesting instruction, reverse your thought to think of the thinking mind, what Dogen calls taking the backward step. Really perceive the mind as it is. Aware of thoughts as thoughts, not as anything else but constructions of the mind, reflections of the outer environment. It's been happening for our whole lives. It's never stopped since the cognitive capacity developed in our little infant brains, and it's been developing ever since. And it seems so real, these inner thoughts. Sometimes they're wonderful, and sometimes they're really mean and unkind, especially if they're directed towards ourselves or sometimes outwardly towards others. Because the mind is just full of judgments. That's one of the main kinds of thoughts that there are, as well as memories and predictions about the future. These amazing and believable thought constructions. And Yangshan says, when you turn to look at your mind like this, are there so many things in there? And if you've really done any of this work that we do in here for any length of time, especially here we are, second day of a Sesshin, you know that there's not that much variety in there. It's the same old stuff. Again and again and again, repeating itself. You'd think we'd get tired of it. but it's yummy. It's delicious. Yes, yes. I'm the worst person on the planet. Oh yeah, that's so comfortable. I love to think that. No, but yet there is comfort in the familiar, as we know, even if it's so off base. Whatever yours are, I'm just talking about myself right now. I hope you get bored with them too, because there's something else. There's something else that this practice leads us into and that we are visited by. The Dharma, the truth, the way things are, reality, however you translate that word, is constantly arising and falling away outside and inside. And there's no difference between outside, inside, and in between, as we determined yesterday, that line from the Grassroot Hermitage. But the monk fails here in a way, because he's what we call in Zen, and Wansong comments on this and other commentators. I first learned this phrase from my friend Dosho Port. He's a board-carrying fellow. That is, he's got a board on his shoulder. So when he goes down the street, he can't see both sides of the street. He can only see one side. And in this case, he can only perceive the falling away of things. In Wansong's commentary, he talks about how important the falling away of things is as a stage in our practice, but it's not the whole thing. And later on, when Yangshan says, you only get one mystery, that's a really interesting translation of whatever that line was, but it's like, I'm doling out mysteries here, and you only get one, don't be greedy. But from the point of view of this board-carrying fellow, he only perceives, he only understands one side of this great mystery, which is emptiness and form, thusness and particularity, oneness and the many. This is a crippling part of our natural development as Zen practitioners. We have to have the whole dropping away thing happen. But then sometimes it's so yummy, we get stuck there. We think, oh, at last, now this is what our ancestors were talking about, and I've achieved it. And then we get in trouble almost immediately, if not within a week or two, what's sometimes called Zen sickness. Board-carrying fellows, women too, don't worry. All of us carry boards on our shoulders, so we can only see what's to one side, and not the whole three dimensions. And then the monk, who understands that he has missed it, and this is so important, I think it really comes through in this translation. He says, don't you have any particular way of guidance? Like, just show me. I know what I know, but I don't know what I don't know. This is an important attitude for a Zen student to develop. We start this way, but then once we start to accumulate experiences, we're given leadership assignments, we pass koans, we can get lost. We can become really, really seriously disabled, board-carrying people. And he recognizes that, and he asks, what should I do? And the Yangshan answers in this translation, to say that I have anything particular or not would be not accurate. In other words, I can't give you advice. I don't have my little rule book in my pocket that I can look you up in and say, oh, yes, you're this kind of person, so you need that kind of thing. All the teachers of the past had a kind of flexibility that they sometimes wrote about, like Lin Ji, who talks about different ways of meeting people. Wansong talks about something that Yangshan once said about that. These varieties of meeting, depending on the condition of the student, the condition of the teacher in that moment, what the student is open to, what the student can comprehend, what the teacher can find to say to that particular person. It's not one particular thing or another. But then he says some praise. He says, you know what? You're going to become a teacher. which is so different from John Tarrant's translation, which veers much towards something that we really prize in Boundless Way, and that is ordinary life. Sit down, wear your clothes. This is all you ever need to do. Just be here, one step in front of the other, open to whatever is arising. This is all you have to know. But he says, it reminds me of things I sometimes say to my daughter, which she doesn't react very well to. You'll see when your child is such and such an age, you'll know what I'm experiencing. He's kind of saying something like that. You'll see when you sit on the teacher's seat, on the high seat, when you put on your teaching robes, you'll know what I'm talking about. He's talking about a great faith here. He's talking about seeing that everyone who comes to him as a student has the spark of seeing all sides already, is already a Buddha, already an awakened one, but just doesn't know it yet. And this person, this board-carrying fellow, has seen one side of the mystery, and that's a great thing. And sometimes we think, well, I haven't even seen one side of the mystery. But that's just your mind making up its endless stories about you. Everyone here listening to this talk has already experienced a touch of awakening. Without it, you just wouldn't be interested. You want to know more. You want that taste to expand. And this is not a conscious thing. There's something, isn't there, that draws you into the practice? It's mysterious. It's a great mystery. And the last line, which is part of our translation, which I want to end with here before I toss this off to David. After this, see on your own. After you've sat down and put on your robes, after you've put yourself in the position of being responsible for carrying this Dharma forward, then it's up to you. It's not that different than what the Buddha said to his disciples when he was dying. Be a light unto yourself. You already know what you need to know. But the thoughts that go through our heads are not it. It's something bigger than that. So the encouragement is always to put down the board, to embrace the mystery, and then, as Dongshan says, to travel the roads. So I'll hand this off to David.
So yesterday it was raining here in Worcester. Raining some more. The sound of the rain from the outside came into the Zendo. And today the sun is shining. This is our life, the life of rain and the life of sun. We come to these retreats and we give ourselves to this practice, give ourselves to this form, the form of the retreat, the form of our zazen, this ancient dance, we might say very small dance. You sit on your cushion, you lie in your bed, you sit on your chair, doesn't matter. Here we encounter the whole world. You sit down and your whole world sits down. Each one of us with the Buddha can say, heaven above and earth below, I am the world honored one. You are the center of your world. Everything comes in and goes out. This mind and the world touch each other. And as we've said, Alan and Melissa so eloquently, not separate, you and the world actually have quite an intimate thing going on. Moment after moment, hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, thinking. And already a Buddha, nothing more to do but to realize this, to sit in the middle of your discomfort, calling out to the Bodhisattva of compassion, calling out to your heart of hearts, having some direction. Sitting down in Zazen is taking some direction, a direction toward the belly button, toward the center. What is it? And so easy to drift to the surface again with the habitual habit force carries us back. And so we turn and we turn. And we turn again. It's not a matter of fighting the good fight. It's not a matter of figuring it out. But it is a matter of cooperating with, of accepting this responsibility. And the responsibility is not for the content of the moment. But this responsibility to meet and this capacity to meet in whatever form. This is our great vow as bodhisattvas, our great vow as practitioners. All of these stories, all of these teachings are arising in you and for you, arising naturally. And here in Sesshin, working so hard and also just sitting around. What'd you do this weekend? Oh, I just sat around. But the possibility of this lovely and dedicated sitting around, this possibility of not knowing what to do, of allowing ourselves to be met again and again, turning and turning and turning once more to this moment. Thank you. So please sit comfortably, and the Zendo will come around a little bit so we can see the screens.
We'll move to the handheld mic here.
So I've just been designated official person who calls on people. So please, in the Zendo, raise your hand if you have something to ask about or offer. On the Zoom screen, raise your Zoom hand. And we'll start with Joanne, who's already raised her hand.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm very touched by this talk. And can you hear me?
Yeah.
And
perfectly.
Putting down the board is like literally like front burner stuff for me. And it has been, but there's something, the edge is becoming nearer. It's drawing nearer. And I just really appreciate the talk. And there's this song that's in the back of my head a lot. It's from Sesame Street. I don't know why it's there, but now I know why. It's where the whole group sings to one of the characters, "You have to put down the ducky if you want to play the saxophone." And it's a song. And so thank you for bringing that all together.
Oh, that's so amazing. You have to put down the ducky if you want to play the saxophone.
It's all like jazz. You got to put down the ducky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Joanne.
I can see the Boundless Way t-shirt now. but there is something that is required of letting be or putting down or some intention. It is wonderful to play the saxophone, right? It is calling to all of us. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, but I think, you know, that when the ducky's in your hand, that's the board carrying. That's exactly right. Thanks so much. Yeah. So somebody in the Zendo here at the temple. Yeah, Carolyn, Jenny's going to hand you the microphone. So they can't, the folks on screen have a hard time hearing us.
Okay. Like so?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm putting down my ducky. I've come to really love this koan, which I absolutely hated when it was first read yesterday. I thought, oh God, another one of these. But the more everybody talks about it, the more you find yourself in it. And I've been spending a lot of time since I've been here these last couple of days, or kalpas maybe, about, you know, the stories, discursive thought, the fixed patterns, all the kinds of things that get in the way. But I'm also reaching a point where I don't trust the other things either, that even pushing all those things aside or making a bigger space, do you get any closer to the reality? Some of these koans and the stories do seem to suggest that one actually experiences something real. And I don't believe that anymore. I mean, some of it's from recent research and stuff about, you know, how we only perceive what's useful to our survival as a species. But I have a very personal experience with it, which has sort of been intensified recently. Ever since I was a little child, I had sort of different color perception in my two eyes. I have no idea how common that is. Maybe lots of people do. But for me, it was a kind of philosophical awakening, because I thought, Jesus, how do I know which is the real color? Or how do I know if either of those colors is what other people see? And I've just had cataract surgery, and that didn't go so well, and it intensified the color differences. So that right now, one eye sees a sort of yellowish brown and the other a very purple. It's like a kind of purple Vaseline through which I'm looking at the world, which is probably a little bit of blood, but it keeps my mind on this all the time. I close one eye and the world looks like this, and I close the other and it looks like that. And I don't know, do I average them together? Does it not matter that maybe we all see it differently? So that's sort of where I'm stuck.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful example, Carolyn. And you know, what's real is, this is something you've known all your life. I'm wondering now if this is partly why you're here. What's real is that this eye sees things one way, this eye sees things another. And so neither of them is seeing things as they are. That's the real thing we can touch in Zen. We really can know that we're constructing this whole phantasmagoria in front of us. And then that can open up a door, you know, and that's sort of where our friend in the koan is. He's in that doorway. And he's marveling at, you know, well, none of this is real. you know, but the teacher is trying to push him through a little bit. Not push him though, have him take his own step. And you don't get to, it's not like take one more step, Carolyn, and you'll see the real universe, but take one more step and see what happens to you when you let go of the sense that you can know for real how things are. How could that be liberating? How could that open all kinds of doors for you that might have stayed closed otherwise?
I was thinking before of that, the image that comes to mind when you say that is stepping off the 10,000 foot pole.
Right.
But now I think it's also maybe putting down your ducky and seeing what comes. It's going to be a wonderful phrase for all of us having a vocabulary now.
Yeah, I think we know what the name of the sesshin is going to be.
Anybody, thank you, Carolyn. Anybody on the Zoom, in the Zoom Zendo? Yeah, Corwin.
Thank you both for that talk and for this different translation. One of the things that you mentioned that we could do is see how we feel about it. And I was thinking how much I hate this translation. I don't think it's actually that much wordier, but I felt like it was. And I kept feeling like, not to you, but to the translators, like, will you just shut up and just like let the koan come through and stop putting so many words on it? And then I had the funny thought of, I wonder if the teachers think that about me when I'm in Dokusan. And but you know, but it just struck me though that you know, we walk around carrying these boards, and I know I do because it's been pointed out to me. And how often do we take the board from one shoulder and then flip it to the other shoulder? And that just really struck me, like, oh yeah, I probably do that all the time. I see one or the other, but you know, I almost feel a little jealous of Carolyn that she can see both at the same time. I know it's probably not, it's not exactly the same thing. It's probably kind of annoying to her, but it's like, just as that concept of being able to see both at the same time. And I guess that's kind of what we're, if we're working towards something, maybe that's something that we kind of see as something that would be nice to be able to do. But anyway, thank you.
I think of self and other the same. I love this. If you have a board on your shoulder, just turn around and you see the other side, but you still just see one side. The mind and the environment, again, it seems so clear that they're two separate things. And so it can clarify what's inside, clarify this mind, or clarify what's outside, subject and object. But it is our way to go beyond, to leap through the one and the many. And what do we find there when we put the ducky down? What is this saxophone? What is this music? What is this life?
And you know, it's not, in my view, exactly that it's one or the other or both together. It's this constant movement in and out and in between. And sometimes it's purple and sometimes it's, what's the other color? Yellowy brown. Sometimes it's the saxophone, but also sometimes it's the ducky. The ducky is really valuable. We've got to make room for the ducky. That's on the back of the t-shirt. Make room for the ducky. Because every single thing, I say it again and again, but it's unbelievable. The yellow brown and the purple are two varieties of reality. One isn't better than the other. The ducky and the saxophone are two different versions of reality. One isn't better than the other. So we move. That the whole point for me is not to be static, not to only see one thing. And I'm also reminded, do you remember that internet meme from a few years ago where there was a dress on the internet. And some people saw it as one color and some people saw it as another color. It was the same picture. And I never, maybe somebody understands the mechanics of that. I don't want to know about it now, but it was so, it's still so mysterious to me. I saw it referred to in a Zen text, actually in a Dharma talk, but it's like, what is reality should be our real question, right? And it's this right now. And then it's this, it's ducky, it's saxophone, it's this color, it's that color. It's, I hate the, you know, the comparing mind that Corwin brought in. Everybody has it. I prefer this to that. I like you, I don't like you. All of it. To make your arms big and wide, really to put the board down, but also every once in a while to put it back up and turn around and just keep turning, like the shakers say. So let's see. Thank you, Corwin. Anybody who's going to offer a comment in the Zendo?
So you had said how like it strikes you when you're reading it. I guess what struck me was with this translation, it felt kinder for some reason, or more like the teacher was really trying to help and the student didn't seem so, I don't know, like being corrected. So yeah, that was what struck me.
Yeah, and it's almost shocking to go from one version to the other, because the Boundless Way Zen version that we get from John Tarrant, and he started with drafts from Robert Aiken, so it goes way back in our lineage. You know, really does kind of set up the monk as someone who thinks that he knows. And that's always a big problem in Zen, you know, to think you've got it, to think that you know. And the other version, he's got some of that, but it seems that in this case, Yangshan feels that what he knows is valid, you know, up as far as it goes. He's giving more of that. And again, you know, the conversation we keep having, what he knows is this eye sees one color, this eye sees the other color, and neither of them is the true color. And yet I love the way that the Boundless Way Zen translation adds, it's not enough for life, right? That this translation says it's not enough for the person. It's enough for faith, but not enough for the person. But it's not enough for life. We can't live in that place to use a single word, emptiness. We can't live in that place of everything dropping away. I don't see anything in there. You know, that nothing is there. I've seen through it all, and that's what I think is the power of the Boundless Way Zen translation. And this is, Melissa said, this is something that speaks very much to our teaching, the way we teach. And I think a big part of the way we teach is to point to human life. How do you bring this into your life? How are you going to live by this? And the monk doesn't have enough to live by. So you can slap him, you know, give him a little slap to let him know that, hit him with a stick, or you can put the robe on him and let him sit, you know, high up in the Zendo, but say, you're not done yet. And either way, he's got a ways to go.
And actually, can I just say that we do that in Boundless Way? We have assistant teachers, senior assistant teachers, Dharma holders who are expected to come forward. And then, you know, we'll say, not quite. It's so there's all this training forever and forever and forever.
That's not quite it.
No, it is.
And I also want to say, that Wansong knows this too. There's a, I wanted to read this paragraph from Wansong in his commentary that basically says, we don't really know what Yangshan said. It's like, when I read that, I went, right. It's like, even then he knew a couple of hundred years later that we didn't know anything about it. we'll see what happens with the Dharma Dialogue. Maybe we'll get to read that. But let's see, where are we? I think we're going back to the Zoom Zendo, and then we'll come back.
Yeah, I've always been interested that Buddhism doesn't have a text going down like so many other religions do. But I also, compounding it, think I read in Thomas Hinton that there weren't verbs in ancient Chinese. So the translation could be all over the place. So it seems like the text we have is so unstable, unclear, undefinite. And it's interesting facing a whole discussion and years of conversation on something when how can you trust the original translation? I don't know what trust means. Maybe just that it interests you.
Well, of course, if you look at the texts of any other religion, none of them are quite as pure or stable as they would claim to be.
That's true.
I was amazed that when I first, in our first Zen experience, our teacher would go on for 45 minutes. He would take some little sentence. And I thought, how can he talk about some little sentence for that long? And I realized he wasn't talking about that sentence. And so these things, these koans, these teachings are our doorways, our entry points. And what we're speaking of and what each one of you is speaking of is not something outside of you. These are just pointing. They aren't the truth. But unless we come and fill it and meet it and trust that which arises in us, the text is nothing.
And it's really this, all of this work is dependent on this facility that not all of us have, but we develop it. That's one of the things we develop in koan practice, especially, but also in just listening to talks and studying liturgy. This associative capacity that human beings can take anything, usually two things is more helpful, and construct a story about it. And so this is, we depend on that capacity in these things. I remember when I was a teenager learning to read tarot cards, and then this went into my, when I was at university and learning how to read the I Ching, because we had a professor who taught the I Ching as music. That's a whole other story. I think I've talked about it before. And I realized that I got really good at reading people's fortunes. It was like scary good. So I stopped. But you could do that with the telephone book. You know, we could just open the book and put our finger somewhere and, oh, Pope's Flower Shop. And then suddenly all this stuff arises. This is a wonderful capacity that we have, that we can be stimulated by anything. So in a way, we're stimulated by these. And then the teacher's job, I think, is to appreciate what comes up in the stimulation and then set it in the context of the Dharma. So, you know, Robert Aitken, I didn't really put that together, as you said, going back to, we're going to emphasize this part of the association. We're going to emphasize ordinary life. And Thomas Cleary says, I'm going to emphasize, you have the capacity to teach and speak about this. It's the same, probably two words, which are probably sit and robe, right? Because as I said at the beginning, and as Anne repeated, there aren't any of these connecting words in Chinese like we're used to in English. So this is important to know that, and this is why trusting yourself is so important. And Wansong says this very thing in his commentary. He says, I don't know what he meant. It could mean this, it could mean that. That's beautiful to have this teacher say that. Yeah. So,
yes, oh, please.
Yeah, I just had to add one thing. Anne, when you brought that out about nouns and verbs, it's like holding a bone out for a dog for me. Right, or maybe a squeeze toy. Right. And what I wanted to say is, what I remember David Hinton saying is not that there aren't verbs, but that the they don't have a sperm noun verb distinction in ancient Chinese like we do in English. And so this, you know, our nouns get us into trouble. And way back to Alan Watts, people have been claiming that in Chinese, you're not as tempted into that problem. So we have a word for self. And so we think that there's a real thing called the self because we have this noun. We have a personal pronoun, I. And so we think that there's a separate person associated with that I. We have a word mind, and so we think there's something called the mind that's separate from the body and from the world. And Hinton is trying to say, you know, you don't have to be trapped by these nouns and other languages. Someone brought this up yesterday. You know, there are other languages, including some Native American languages, that use verbs where we would use nouns. And the idea is that this might help us to not get so caught up in our delusions. Maybe, maybe not. But I think that's what he was trying to say. And thanks so much for bringing it out.
Yeah, I'm going to just chew on the toy a tiny bit more. but in my undergraduate studies were in anthropology, and I did some field work in South America with indigenous people in the Andes. And we were both speaking Spanish as a second language. And their native language, Quechua, does that. Everything that is, you don't walk anywhere. Walking happens. There's not even any verb tenses. And so I learned to speak Spanish that way. And when I went back to school, you know, my teachers were like, oh, my God, you sound like an Indian, which was what you would say in the 70s. But there's a whole school of linguistics, Worf Sapir hypothesis, that your brain is really formed by the language you grow up in, even if you learn a second language. And it did change my brain to have to learn Spanish in the Quechua style. It was weird, but they knocked me out of it, unfortunately. Maybe not completely. Yeah. So, Dave.
I agree.
I just wanted to share that it was just interesting to me how different these koans made me feel. That everyone's been saying this same thing, and I really relate to it. And I, it was also interesting. People have also said this, that how quickly my mind makes these stories based on what I contextualize from what I hear. And so in the first story, when the student kind of seems like this person is pretending to be something that they're not, I think Alan said that, is he the barbarian, or is he wearing the beard of the, is he dressing up like the barbarian? And so I immediately have this feeling of, I don't like this when people dress up like the barbarian. Like, I like the barbarian. I want to be like the barbarian. I don't want to be dressing up, et cetera. But then, and I thought about that feeling because it felt kind of bad to me, and that there's something that felt judgmental about it. And so, and then I thought about, okay, why, what about my own son who's 5 years old and he dresses up all the time in front of like things that he's not. So when he does that, I don't feel that way. I feel like he's beautiful and young and curious. It's innocent. So there's like a loving feeling for it. Whereas the student, I felt the opposite. I felt this kind of like distaste, et cetera. And it's the same thing. It's dressing up like something that you're not, but the context of it made me have this very different reaction. And so, but I think, so to kind of end, I don't want to go on forever, but I think that it's just, I never really know which one's right, like which one it actually is. And so, I don't know. I just think the last thing I think is just that in both things, and Aaron said this, that the teacher in some sense kind of loved the student in both. And I actually felt in both of the stories, the teacher still loved the student, even the student that was putting on the beard, there was still that feeling that I got from it. So
Yeah. I so appreciate you talking about, we can say, well, I don't like it when people pretend or put on airs, and how wonderful this image of your son, you know, superhero. How wonderful. Yes, totally. So then I'm thinking about putting on clothes and taking off. And is it the right eye or the left eye? Is it purple or is it brown? And the answer is in this moment, just what it is, right? And so all of us this weekend, we are all monks. All of us have run away, and this is your whole life. You have no other life. People say, well, they put on funny clothes and they do all this stuff, but it is the fullness. And when our grandson runs around screaming with a cape on, you know, it is the full, the superhero is here. There is no doubt. And this possibility, one, of noticing which parts we're judging or which parts of us are judging, well, that. And this possibility for all of us as teacher to appreciate all the manifestations of ourselves and of everyone else. Yeah. Thank you.
So maybe we'll just take a couple more. One from the Zoom Zendo, Pierce.
I left Alan's comment in response to Carolyn's double vision. I actually have the same problem as a result of eye surgery. And when I close one eye, the world tilts up at an angle. That's the eye that I don't use that much. But at any rate, the comment that struck me was that Alan is presenting the monk in the koan as somebody who is on the brink of realizing that he doesn't know and that he actually can't know. And in relation to the question of translation, I love to compare different translations, although I don't think that helps me to elucidate things. But it seems to me that if I were capable of reading the Chinese characters, I wouldn't and have had a much greater understanding of the culture, or even got into a time machine, I wouldn't really be that much better off, because even the original is actually a transposition of experience into those wonderful characters, and truth is not a thing. So, but thanks for that comment. But because the idea that what is the insight? What is the important insight that we don't know what we're seeking to know so desperately, and that it doesn't matter?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for saving us from the potential fantasy that if we were all scholars of Chinese and, you know, could read volume after volume, we would know. And right, because even if we were sitting there with Yangshan, you know, Yangshan would be the first to tell us, the moment I opened my mouth, I was distorting things.
Yeah, and last one, Deb. So, it's the rain and the sun and the sitting in the robe. So it's very discreet and concrete, and then the board. But then it's like these, what I'm struggling with is these habit forces that are, where do they come from? Why are they here? And it's just very strong. So I just wondered if you could speak to that.
Doesn't make any difference. I mean, of course, it can be interesting to pursue that.
Yeah.
But in a sense, that's still the ducky. Right? Where do they come from? If I could just read Chinese, I'd really get to. So they are here, and each one of us can verify each person sitting around the Zendo and on the screen.
can verify the habit force is strong and sometimes feels overwhelming. But there is something that is calling to you, and that something is worth your whole life. Yeah. So let's come back to restore the zendo, come back to our zazen posture for a few more.